This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hi there, I'm Helen Farmer. Great to have you with us on the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast and a real health focus today. Mental health and physical health. Looking at the super flu. Oh my goodness, everyone I speak to seems to be getting struck down. The aching limbs, the croaky throat. So what can we do to protect ourselves? Viruses are back with a vengeance, says Dr. Rania of Circle Care Clinic. She is on hand today, offering up some advice on the supplements you should need to take, when and who should get the flu jab, and ultimately what to do if you do get struck down. We were also in conversation with Dr. Mubarak Al Said, weighing in on your teeth problems. He's an orthodontist. Do you need braces? What is the best whitening treatment? He was on hand with that free dental clinic. And speaking to fitness superstar Kelsey Wells, she shot to megastardom when she talked about Screw the Scales, a visual representation of how the number doesn't always represent health. She's got nearly 3 million followers on Instagram. She's sharing her philosophy with us. And why do we love getting spooked? Clinical psychologist Dr. Thraya was on hand to talk about the psychology of scary movies, Halloween around the corner, and film expert William Mullally sharing his scariest movies of all time. So what's yours?
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking health this afternoon, and I want to know how you're feeling. Let me know, because there's an awful lot around right now. Joining us to tell us exactly what is going on and how we can protect ourselves from some nasties is Dr. Rania. She is consultant paediatrician and medical director at Circle Care Clinic. Dr. Rania, what is going on? Because we've got kids off sick, teachers off sick, people saying they've got the worst cold they've ever had. COVID, of course, still bubbling along under the surface as well. What's coming into clinic for you?
The viruses are back. We're basically at the busiest we've ever been, even compared to pre-COVID times. So this last September and October now, we're almost coming to the end of that, have been the busiest in a long, long time. And probably so many things, so many factors causing this, but it must be the fact that lockdown led to many, many viruses being pushed out of the way and suppressed in such a way that they weren't passing from person to person, and especially with the little ones. So I would look at maybe the 18-month-old to 4-year-old group, so that's sort of nursery, early years age group, which have spent a year and a half or 2 years not getting sick. So that was the highlight of COVID. And now suddenly they are it's like the petri dish of viruses.
It's so true. Because I mean, my kids are kind of through that now, but there was a good couple of years where I was wondering what exactly we were paying for, because they were never at nursery and it was constant snotty noses. And then, as you say, COVID hits, the one who has asthma has been to ICU with respiratory problems, absolutely healthy as you can like. I mean, just incredible. And now we're seeing this kind of rebound, I guess, for want of a better phrase. Obviously, exactly. We've just had half term, people traveling, people bringing back things and planes, as we know. Good environment for that petri dish. So what kind of name are we giving some of the issues? I mean, you said viruses there. Is there anything more specific?
Yes. So RSV, that's respiratory syncytial virus. I think more people have heard of this now than ever before. Mm. This is a virus that normally hits or is concerning with infants, because it always drops to the chest. It causes something called bronchiolitis, which is, for all intents and purposes, a viral pneumonia. So this virus, by the time most children are 18 months, they sort of have it in one way or another. But what's happened now is so many of these children have never had it, and so many of their parents have not been exposed to it again through their children. So it's just hit. And this started around May or June, and we've seen this in so many different countries, where normally the spike is in the winter, but it started earlier in the year when I think restrictions were eased and children went back. So this is a horrible virus with 5 to 7 days of high fever, really bad congestion and cough, with some children developing some asthma-like symptoms and many of them going on to develop ear infections and needing antibiotics at the end of it. So that's one. And the other one, hand, foot and mouth. I think we've all come across this. It's the dreaded hand, foot and mouth virus. It is quite grim. And it's what's horrible about it as well is from the minute the symptoms start, you know that you've brought your child 7 days at home. It's almost as long as the COVID quarantine time. What's the other one? Norovirus. So lots of these stomach viruses. And norovirus, usually is what you would get on cruise ships. That's when you hear a cruise ship has come down with a stomach virus. It's quite contagious. It's quite interesting to hear that it's been isolated in almost every person who's ended up in A&E with vomiting and diarrhea. And it is extremely contagious because the children will vomit, even adults will, and diarrhea, shared toilets, etc. And that's how it's passed on. So it's mainly been the respiratory viruses, with RSV being the highlight of those, hand, foot and mouth, and the stomach viruses. And influenza is beginning to rear its ugly head up again.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I've had a number of friends who have been, the whole family's struck down.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We have got a doctor in the house. Dr. Rania is here, consultant paediatrician, medical director at Circle Care Clinic. As we talk about what so many people are talking about, the super cold, flus, generally feeling a bit rubbish. So, Dr. Rania, you're saying you basically haven't been this busy in the longest time, people coming into clinic there. You're obviously looking at children. You mentioned norovirus, RSV, bronchiolitis, and, of course, influenza. Can we talk a little bit about the flu jab? Is it too late in the season to get it? When does it start to be effective?
It's definitely not too late. Now is the right time. If you look at all the studies and all the advice, it's normally mid-October onwards, that's when the season starts. And it continues all the way until the end of February. So I would say that if you haven't had your flu jab yet, don't worry, it's not too late. Get one now, especially if you're planning Christmas travels or winter travels. So if you're traveling abroad to somewhere slightly cooler, where there are even more viruses going around, it definitely makes sense to get a flu jab.
I know an awful lot of people are reconsidering those Christmas travel plans in light of COVID numbers in the UK, for example. And, I've got a lot of friends and family who are talking about that chainsaw throat, the dripping nose, the aching limbs. A lot of people feeling really, really poorly. So let's talk prevention and then we're going to talk treatment. And let's look at adults, Dr. Rania, if that's okay. What are some of the things that we could and should be doing to ward off any of these nasties we're talking about?
Nothing beats just basic common sense, which is plenty of sleep, not that's easy to get, good diet, good hydration, and staying away if you're sick or staying away from someone who does look visibly sick. I think these viruses cannot pass person to person unless you're quite up close and inhaling those droplets. And we know from all the lockdowns and distancing and mask wearing and COVID how effective it is staying away from someone who's sick, how effective that is in stopping you getting sick. So basic measures of good hygiene, sleep hygiene, as I call it, good diet, keeping yourself at home when you're sick and as well your child, and then boosting any nutritional deficiencies you've got. Vitamin D is one that gets a lot of coverage, and there are some studies supporting how effective it is having that at an optimal level. Through protecting your skin barriers, your respiratory lining barriers, so then you're meant to not inhale as many of these viruses, or if you do, then they don't affect you as badly. But also there is some evidence to say that it does boost your immune system. So that would be one that I would look at boosting. And then plenty of vitamin C if you're not a fruit eater or, you don't eat that many fresh fruits and all of this advice extends to children as well. So it's not just adults.
But it's really interesting to me that, people's immune systems are so different. They're as unique to us as our fingerprints are. But let's say someone does get sick, and let's use a kind of super cold as an example, because flu, we've talked about getting the jab. Obviously, people need to get their COVID boosters right now if the timing is right. Mm-hmm. But if you get struck down with that really nasty head cold, the aching limbs, just feeling congested, what do you recommend in terms of medication? Is there a need to go to the doctor?
So it all depends on how well you feel you're managing your symptoms, because ultimately a virus, as a virus, will have to run its course. Most viruses have a life cycle of 7 days. And whatever you do, you cannot shorten that duration. But what you can do is focus on the different symptoms. And as you said, different people will get different severity levels of symptoms. and see if you can manage those. So let's say you get a fever, managing that fever if it gets to the point where it's uncomfortable. There is evidence to say that letting a fever run around 38 without 38 degrees C without medicating it is good in terms of getting rid of viruses. It's a defense mechanism. But if at that level you're feeling very unwell with it, then obviously treat yourself. So with a paracetamol or ibuprofen. Decongestants can help, especially if you're at the stage where you really cannot breathe through your nose and that's affecting your quality of sleep. So nothing beats saline nasal spray, you know, and using quite forceful spraying because that mechanically flushes out lots of the viral carriage you've got in your nose and thus mechanically decongest it. You can go on to use some spray decongestants. And then, you know, different people use different home remedies, from gargling with salt to using honey, you know, to using lemon tea, ginger. So it really is anything that makes your symptoms feel better while you ward this off. And of course, plenty of hydration, plenty of sleep. And, you know, it's probably time to lift your feet up and read a good book while you get better, if you can.
Oh, I think that is such a good point. I really do, because so many of us are so reluctant to take time off. And unfortunately, well, for one thing, it's if you're back in the office, it stops you spreading things to other people. But also your body needs that rest. So, yeah, don't be a martyr. Don't be a hero. If you really are unwell, book some time off and use it to, I don't know, watch Squid Game, watch Succession. Maybe something more gentle. Dr. Rania, thank you so much for your time today. And if you are feeling unwell, you're definitely not alone. And if you do need to go to the doctor, get yourself there. Thank you, Dr. Rania, wishing you and the team at Circle Clinic all the very best. Keep positive, test negative. Any final words for anyone who's feeling a bit rubbish today?
No, just what you said. You're not alone. We're all feeling it, every single one of us. I'm home today with exactly that.
Oh, no! Okay.
Not me, one of my children, but there you go.
Oh, yeah, well, that's so, the thing. No, literally no one is immune. Lemon, honey and ginger.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rania. Take care of yourselves and the family.
Thank you. Bye.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking teeth this hour. Joined live on the line by the co-founder at Line Dental Centre, Dr. Mubarak Al Saeed, on hand to help. So it could be to do with cosmetic, it could be to do with pain. I hope it's not. But Doctor is here live on the line. How are you today, sir?
Very good, thank you.
And can I ask, I mean, you've got a gorgeous smile I can see on Microsoft Teams, but what's keeping you busy? What are people coming in for right now, even in the wake of all of us wearing masks all the time?
Well, especially actually after the COVID-19, where weddings and all events were postponed. So people are ready now for the engagement parties, for the wedding, for the, you know, all the social activities. So we're busier than ever before now.
That's good. We want to be back and smiling. Whitening seems to be a really hot topic right now. And I don't know if it's my Instagram algorithm, but I am getting all sorts of whitening products. Oh my goodness, now I'm feeling paranoid that they're seeing my teeth and think I need to do it. Kind of thrown at me through social media. And we've had a number of questions about exactly this. Some people saying they've been offered products for 20 dirhams, obviously in clinic procedures costing thousands. What do we need to know about whitening that is not going to compromise our enamel or too much sensitivity?
Okay, so actually you have two types of whitening, which is we call the professional whitening, which you do in the clinics, and they are the over-the-counter whitening. Now, as dentists, we always prefer to be to do the professional whitening. And I know it could be, you know, expensive and costly for some, and that's fine to use the over-counter. But what we look for in the over-counter product is to be, you know, ADA, which is American Dental Association approval on them. That way we guarantee that the percentage or the concentrations of the whitening gel is not high. And in a way, it will not, you know, harm your gum in any way. So the difference between the two, in the clinics, we have two types of whitening. We have what we call the home bleaching gel, which basically a dentist will take a mold or a scan of your teeth, and then they will fabricate a tray where you put the gel in a small percentage. And that way, the tray is custom made for your personal teeth. And in this way, the gel hopefully will not overflow to the gum, and that's where it starts to irritate the gum and, you know, problems start happening.
That makes sense. People getting a bit slapdash and product heavy, and that's, as you say, can affect the gum, which sounds pretty painful. 4001, we've got lots of questions to get through. As I said, delighted to be joined by Dr. Mubarak, co-founder Align Dental Centre. Now, Align implies to me some orthodontics. And back in my day, it was all, you know, your train tracks and your headgear. I've currently got Invisalign and it's working really well. I'm not wearing it now because it does make me a little bit lispy. But we've had lots of questions about teeth straightening. Dora saying, I've worn braces 3 times in my life. I'm 39 now, want to try aligners, but are my teeth too weak? Does that happen if you've tried different alignment techniques over the years? Is it kind of past the point of being able to help with anything new?
Yes. Now, as a side effect of having braces, any type of braces, as a side effect, the roots of the teeth start to get a bit shorter. So in general, about 1 millimeters of the roots get shorter. So that's not a big deal, and it will not in any way reduce the stability or the strength of your teeth. But now if you start having braces after braces, then the roots might get shorter and shorter. That doesn't mean that you cannot have braces again, but it means that we as orthodontists, we have to take an x-ray, make sure that the foundation, the gum, the bone, the teeth are in good shape, and there is no contradictions or contraindications of having braces again.
And a question here about prices from Jaya, which I think is always an interesting one, saying, why do prices vary so much? One clinic offering the same product for 12,000, another one for 26,000. Fair comment. If it's someone different who's got a different set of teeth and you're looking to achieve different results, but for the same patient, why can you get such a huge variety when it comes to braces?
Okay, but before I answer this question, I would like to add on to the previous question, which is the 39 years old. Now, it's important to note that there is no age limit when it comes to braces. So you could be 39, you could be 110, you still can have braces. Of course, having in mind that, you know, the basis of the tooth and the structure is in sound and in good health.
That's good to know. Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
So coming on to cost then, if age can vary, so can price. Why are we seeing sometimes double the price in particular clinics?
Yeah. So in life, that the same situations with everything else. Now, when it comes to cost, there are some factors which impact the costing for the patients. Number one is the material that the clinics use. Some materials are just like cars, you know. You have, for example, a dental implant that is very affordable, and another one which is like a Bentley or a Mercedes, which is more expensive than others. So the parts and the materials that the dentists use can have an impact on the cost, that number one. And number two, also the dentists themselves, their experience, their qualifications. Mm-hmm. For example, if you have a dentist who is board certified, a UK graduate and from the top schools, it is that particular dentist. It is more expensive on the clinics and on the owners than, I would say, a dentist with a lower qualifications, if you know what I mean. So the dentist is one big factor impacting, and their experience and their qualifications impacting the costs of the treatment. So it's really important now, as with the previous question, that she had braces for 3 times. Now, what I don't recommend listeners that to go for the most affordable clinics. They could have some good dentists, but what you need to make sure that the dentist has a good qualifications, good experience before you go on, because you don't want to go in for the treatment and finish with not the results and the great, healthy, beautiful smile that you're looking for, and then having another braces, and another one, and another one.
Pay peanuts, you get monkeys.
Which could be even more expensive than having a one good quality treatment.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking teeth this afternoon, our fantastic doctor of the hour. It is Dr. Mubarak Al-Sayed, the co-founder of Align Dental Centre. We're talking earlier about how it's never too late to get braces, but what about too early? Rasha has been in touch saying, my nine-year-old has really crooked teeth. Can she already wear braces or should I wait? What age do you tend to recommend starting to get some orthodontics work done?
Well, first of all, we recommend the first visit to the orthodontist to be at 8 or 9 years old. Now, that doesn't mean that at that age, braces is required, but we say in general, for most cases, the best age is to have braces is around 11 or 12 years old. That's where all the permanent teeth are out. But in some scenarios and in some cases we need the more benefit to start earlier at 9 years old. So whether the questions whether her kid or her son is one of those cases is the decision of the orthodontist. So I recommend her to go to check if her son falls into that categories of needing to start orthodontic treatment and at an earlier age.
So a good assessment needed. All right. Okay. Hope that helps. But it's not beyond the realms of possibility. And a question here from Naya come through on the Messenger app saying, does my five-year-old really need to stop sucking her thumb? She only does it at night and it helps her fall asleep. That when they start sleeping, you really don't want to do anything to mess it up. So I understand your reluctance here. But from a professional point of view, Dr. Mubarak, what do you recommend about thumb sucking?
All right. Now, the thumb sucking, it could have some side effects. For example, pushing the teeth out, we call it constricting the upper arch also. And at 5 years old, all of her teeth are milky teeth. Now, we know from research that this side effect will tend to disappear when the permanent teeth comes out. But we do encourage the parents to encourage their children to stop that habit, because what we don't want it to happen is for this habit to carry on, after that age, even when the permanent teeth start coming out, and that will be a longer lasting problem. So we have to be, we also can have the help of a dentist, because what we don't want to be is not to force the kids and start being aggressive about it, because that will not help. So what we need to do is have some positive reinforcement, some encouragement to hopefully stop that habit, because it will have some side effects.
I'm hearing bribery there, big time. Last question, Martha saying, does your expert tend to recommend an electric or manual toothbrush? What's your preference, sir?
Now, it's important to note that even with a manual toothbrush, if you use it correctly and you use it for the recommended time, which is 2 minutes, it will be efficient and sufficient to have a good oral hygiene. But now for sure that electric toothbrushes do offer some benefits over the manual ones, such as more plaque removal than a manual toothbrush. And also with the timer built in, this will guarantee that the people will stick to the time, the 2 minutes, as you know, it will have some timer built in the electric toothbrush, as well as you don't need to be an expert to brush your teeth with the toothbrush, as all you have to do is just pass it along the teeth and the gum line. So we know that from studies now, electric toothbrushes are more effective than manual toothbrushes. And whether you use electric toothbrush or a manual one, if you use the right technique and the right timing, both are good.
Doctor, thank you so much for your time today. Really, really appreciate it. And to anyone who we didn't get to, apologies. We do talk teeth on a regular basis, so we will put them away for another day. You can find Dr. Mubarak at Align Dental Centre. A message here from Rowan saying, I sucked my thumb until I was 8, never had braces, and my teeth were perfectly straight. I sucked my thumb until my 30s. So, yeah. hence having Invisalign right now. But absolutely, I was the same growing up. Absolutely fine.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're talking health and fitness today, and who better to join us than Kelsey Wells? She's an Instagram star, fitness trainer with nearly 3 million followers, and she rose to fame after a transformation photo she posted urging women to screw the scales. It went viral in 2016. She's here in Dubai for the Active Show. Kelsey, thank you so much for being with us today. I know you are incredibly busy, so really appreciate you taking the time to share your insights. I wanted to ask you, first of all...
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. You've said in the past that working out is not about changing how your body looks. Can you tell us a little bit more about your thoughts around that philosophy?
Absolutely. You know, so growing up, I was kind of, I really internalized some unhealthy, toxic dialogue surrounding health and fitness. And that was kind of the belief that exercise was something directly related to your physical aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And it was something that, unfortunately, I did out of hate for my body for a very long time. And it wasn't until after the birth of my son that I used fitness for the very first time to help myself heal and empower myself, as opposed to out of a negative place. And I really understand now from my personal experience and also as a professional in the fitness industry that your motive for your movement truly, truly matters. And when we understand that fitness is about caring for our health and first and foremost, right? I mean, I'm not saying it's bad to have aesthetic goals. As long as those are gone about in a healthy way, that's great. It can be, you know, motivating. But first and foremost, our fitness and our efforts in fitness and nutrition and exercise should be to care for our health and to care for ourselves. And of course, a facet of that is understanding that our health is not just physical, and that our mental and emotional and physical health are all entwined.
I think that's really interesting and refreshing for a lot of people, because as you say, so many of us grow up being conditioned to think that exercise is punishment and it's something that has to be endured rather than enjoyed.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. You know, I'm proud to be hopefully part of a dialogue that is shifting, you know, those old ways of thinking and kind of dismantling that and helping, you know, people reclaim that. I always say I'm on a mission to help everyone redefine fitness. And that really begins with that. It's with understanding that your health is an intrinsic part of your life. If you're alive, you're on a health journey, you can't fail it. You know, we get caught up in these goals or doing challenges or whatever, and those can be fine. But the thing is, people think, oh, I've fallen off, or oh, I've been out of it. And they shame themselves for their lack of effort or not doing enough. And when you remove that and the timelines fall away, you realize you can't fail. And it just becomes about, what can I do to care for myself and my health today? And it really, when you simplify it, you'll have so much more success. And also you'll start to understand that it really is simple, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And thank you for mentioning the fact that motherhood was part of your realization as well. How did having your baby change the way you felt about your body and perhaps your health in general?
Yeah, I mean, it changed everything. When I had my son, I was 24. And I, like many women, experienced some pretty severe postpartum anxiety and some postpartum depression. Mm-hmm. And that's something I speak very openly about, you know. Over 1 in 4 women experience these things to some extent, and it needs to be normalized, and all shame needs to be removed from that, right? But I found myself in this place where my mental health was really struggling, and on the same hand of that, I was in a really, really negative place with just my self-talk, you know, and that's due to, you know, the past years of my life in young adulthood really harboring and fostering a toxic, negative dialogue towards myself. And it's something that I didn't even realize I was doing for a long time, right? But when I had my son, I found myself kind of in this rock bottom place. And I realized it was almost for the first time I didn't shame myself for that. I just realized, you know what, this is where I am physically with my abilities. This is where I am mentally with my postpartum struggle. This is where I am with my emotional and mental well-being, and that's okay, but I can change it. Mm-hmm. And no one can change it for me. You know, only you can change your life when it comes to those things. And so it was like this epiphany that my physical workouts were a literal metaphor for the work that I was doing to switch, to have, you know, remember how to live from self-love and to see myself in a positive light and treat myself out of love and respect, right? And so it all really went hand in hand. And that's why I'm such an advocate for all the things that I speak to, right? Because it really does matter. The way we speak to ourselves matters. It matters so much. And it's a very formative force in your life, the way that you're speaking to yourself in your mind. And are you tearing yourself down or are you building yourself up? And if you're tearing yourself down, you can rewire that, but it takes conscious effort. Mm-hmm. And so I began that conscious effort the same time that I began to rebuild my physical strength. And so it was really, kind of a symphony of a journey, I guess, that led me here.
I think for so many people, that comparison is the root of a lot of, you know, heartache, you know, seeing people weighing different things or the, you know, the sizes in somebody's clothes. And as you say, that self-talk just gets more and more negative, and it can stop people taking action because they don't want to be the biggest or the weakest in the gym. And I wondered if you had any advice for someone who might be feeling gym anxiety or kind of workout nerves about exercising for the first time or working out after a long time, you know, ways of just getting started.
I really just want to encourage you to be mindful about the motive for your movement. So recognize that even if you haven't lived from this place or understood this before, you can come at exercise from a healthier place. You know, if you're exercising just to shrink the number on the scale or this tag on your clothes, that's not good for your mental health. Set intentions. Every time you go to do a workout, I know this sounds cheesy, but it's really powerful and important. Mm-hmm. You know, think like, I'm doing this workout because I'm caring for my body, because I'm grateful that I'm even healthy enough to exercise, right? Like, I'm doing this to have some mental clarity, to get some endorphins. Like, remind yourself of the positive, literal, physiological changes that happen when you exercise. And the more you do that, the more you'll start to see those changes in your life and feel that, and the more natural it will become, right? So when you're starting your journey, tip number one, if you will be to focus on having your motive. And then my second tip I would say to someone just beginning is to take it one day at a time. It can be fun to sign up for like a challenge or, you know, find something that's a certain duration of time to check off, which can be good, but it can also be overwhelming. When you're trying to implement exercise when you currently have a sedentary lifestyle, that's a really big mountain to climb.
It's so huge. It one day it's at a time. Huge. And, you know, today, and you're thinking about changing diet at the same time. And, you know, you're trying to juggle everything you were doing normally. And in some ways, you're kind of setting yourself up to fail. And then you get that big, you know, oh, I fell off the wagon. I can't get back on. It's not meant to be. I've failed mm-hmm. again. I'm not someone who should be exercising. And this becomes this kind of perpetual cycle of
self-shame. Ugh. And then you feel worse. It's really kind of simple. I mean, self-confidence is literally built through building self-trust. And so it's just like you said, people have these audacious, massive things like, I'm going to overhaul my diet overnight, or I'm going to train 6 days a week for an hour. And there, it's too much. And you are kind of setting yourself up to fail. And then you pile on that guilt. And then you're in a worse place and you feel less confident than when you started, right? But what if you made a goal? I'm going to exercise. I'm going to move my body for 15 minutes every day. And each day you wake up and you find the time to move for 15 minutes. You don't put any more to it than that. And you do that until that becomes part of your new normal. And once that's no longer overwhelming, then set, you know, go for another goal. But it's really about small daily efforts. And focus on one thing at a time until it becomes your new normal, and then pick something else, right? Because we are seeking to change our lives and to live healthier, happier lifestyles.
Kelsey, I would never forgive myself if I didn't ask you a question on the personal front. And it's interesting you're talking there about challenges, because a couple of weeks ago, I went to Africa and climbed Kilimanjaro, and I was... It was amazing. It was unbelievable. Incredible.
Wow.
And I was...
Congratulations.
Thank you. On top of the world for a couple of days. And I thought I'd come back to mm-hmm. Dubai feeling like I could tackle anything and that my body was so capable. And I am very, very proud of myself. But what I've actually found is now I've got this massive anticlimax and all the adrenaline is gone. All the dopamine is gone. I haven't got a goal.
Yeah.
And I'm feeling really flat. And I know in my heart that when I feel like exercising least, that's when I should be getting into the gym and moving. But I just can't get motivated. So that's my kind of cautionary tale to anyone who's thinking about doing a challenge. Just think about the after. Think about, you know, what next. But how can I get moving again? How can I start to get back into action?
Yeah, you know what? Thank you for sharing that. You should be incredibly proud of yourself. And I've been there. I understand exactly what you're saying. But I'm being from Utah. I'm an avid hiker. When the weather's, you know, good, I'm outside hiking. And I want you to think of it like this. how did you climb Mount Kilimanjaro? You literally did that. You achieved this great, amazing achievement, but you achieved that literally one step at a time. And I think we lose sight. You know, we think of life in terms of successes or failures or accolades or accomplishments, but really life is a journey. And I'm sure if you looked back on that hike in that time, like what you're proud of isn't standing at the top, right? Like if you got dropped on a helicopter at the top, you wouldn't have that sense of accomplishment. It's every step that you took that got you there. It's about every day waking up and taking that one step. So I want you to just make a goal today to move your body, and then the next day do the same thing. And you will get back into the swing of it pretty quickly. The big accomplishments are in the small daily.
Thank you, because I think that's the kind of knee-jerk reaction, isn't it? It's like, oh, now I'm going to do Machu Picchu now, and it becomes this kind of roller coaster rather than it just being grateful that I can exercise and do things, and I'm able to carve out even 15 minutes a day amongst being a mum and working and all the craziness to actually kind of honour myself to do that and enjoy it.
That's something to be immensely proud of. Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much again. Really appreciate it. And thank you for your honesty too. I think it's so important for people to acknowledge that it's not always easy. But when you find your why, it definitely does get a little bit easier. Kelsey, thank you so much. Have a wonderful, wonderful afternoon ahead.
You too. Thank you.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Oh, we're getting into spooky season. Scary movies are something you either really love or avoid at all costs. Logically, we should be running away from things that induce fear, but horror movies have this way of drawing us back in. It's a little confusing, a bit odd when you stop and think about it, but horror entertainment is a very popular genre, especially at this time of year. So do you love them or do you loathe them? And what is your scariest movie? Let us know. And joining us on Microsoft Teams is Dr. Thryer, clinical psychologist at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. And we're talking about why we love being spooked. Dr. T, do you like being spooked?
I do.
Okay, all right, Dark Soul, I want to know more. Have you always enjoyed scary movies, Thryer?
I have. So the first movie I watched when I was in my early teens by myself was The Exorcist, the original.
Oh, the full head-spinning pea soup situation. And it's interesting, those early teen years do tend to be those bonding experiences with friends, sleepovers, scaring each other silly with ghost stories. What is it about that time where we just seem to be really testing our boundaries?
Well, I mean, it's also the rush of testosterone, right?
Yes.
So this is where we're kind of looking for that thrill-seeking tendency that we have. And so just that hormonal shift that we have in our teens is usually where we start to do things that we think is going to induce that rush that we're looking for.
And I think a lot of people spend the rest of their lives kind of chasing that rush and trying to make things more extreme, you know, more, you know, the gorier, the better. Whereas others, myself included, I'm such a wimp now. I've totally shied away from horror films. And while I enjoyed them as a teen, I'm useless. I don't want to watch anything to do with like war or football hooliganism, nothing gory. I did watch Squid Game, but I can just think of better ways to spend my evening. And it's kind of interesting as we get older. But let's go back to the brain. What happens in our brain when we get frightened, Thryer?
Well, when we actually get scared, we experience this rush of adrenaline, and our body releases endorphins and dopamine, which at times can feel quite euphoric. And that subsequently gets us feeling the gratification of the relief that we're actually safe. Because in reality, when you're watching something scary or when you're engaging in something a bit thrillful or freaky, it's kind of like a controlled fear. So we know that, you know, whatever it is, we're experiencing this rush of hormones, but equally it's going to end and everything's going to be okay and we're actually safe. So that you're not only getting the rush of the rush of the endorphins and dopamine, which is our feel-good hormone, but you're also getting the rush of that relief that comes right after. So that sense of control is actually quite key to the enjoyment of experiencing fear.
Which makes sense. When you break it down like that, it does make sense. It's a sense of escapism. There's a defined time period, and then, you know, you can go back to your house with the lights on in every single room. Are there any benefits to the brain about being scared in this way?
Of course. So this kind of thrill seeking can actually be quite satisfying, and it's actually confidence building. So what ends up happening is that when you experience something in a controlled environment that makes you scared, but then you get over it, what ends up happening is that you feel this confidence that, oh, I can do the next thing. And so it does build a little bit of that confidence, that self-esteem. And this is even, it shows itself when you get over a phobia, for instance. So you work towards moving past something that you're scared of. It gives you that sense of, you know, I'm doing really well, and that satisfaction, that confidence. So it can be very beneficial. Sometimes it can go a little bit too far, where people start to crave that rush over and over again, and then people get, you know, into more risky behavior.
Ooh, okay. I'm keen to know more, but I also want to know your favorite scary movie. So let me know on 4001, Halloween just around the corner, if anyone's planning a movie night. I want to know, what's the scariest film you have ever seen? Lots of you getting in touch on this, unsurprisingly. Shane saying Insidious, Hereditary, is getting a couple of votes as well. Tariah, what scares you when you think about kind of different genres? Is it the kind of, you know, the gore, or the, you know, the element of surprise, you know, the creeping around? Is it the, you know, what you can't see? What freaks you out?
Honestly, children.
Oh, children, it's the worst. Movies. It's the worst Paranormal Activity. I'm like, get that child away from me immediately.
It's not even the movie that I have been scared of since I watched it to this day is The Ring. The girl in The Ring.
Yeah, the crawling around.
I have never been so traumatized from a movie in my life.
Well, what does it say about our personalities then if we do tend to enjoy horror films or even certain genres?
Well, in general, usually people who tend to seek thrilling or risk-taking or that rush, it usually indicates that we are kind of more responsive to dopamine. Mm-hmm. So we tend to not only crave it, but we respond quite well to it. Because, you know, when we are watching or engaging in something scary, we are technically targeting our fight or flight and or freeze response, right? Because it's kind of like a threat that's coming at us. And so our primitive brain is looking to defend and protect ourselves. But for some people who, for instance, experience anxiety or have had serious traumatic experiences in their life, this could be quite difficult for them. But for individuals who have tended to work through things that have been fearful for them, will tend to get a kick out of it. But this is where it can become quite problematic, because they tend to crave more and more of it. It's almost like a drug. It becomes very addictive for them. And sometimes that can put them in a lot of trouble. So individuals who have that thrill-seeking type of personality are quite responsive to the neurotransmitter dopamine. But also, what's really interesting is that there's a lot of research that shows that people who enjoy horror films score low in empathy and fearfulness, which are kind of associated with more enjoyment and desire to watch horror films, right? And the thrill film watchers, okay, have higher levels of empathy and adventure seeking, whereas film watchers that are looking for gore are usually lower in empathy and fearfulness, but they're high in adventure seeking. So you can tell that there are some personality differences in the kind of scary movies that you're watching, not just like horror, but also in terms of like that goriness where like there's blood and guts and things all over the place.
I wanted to ask you about if you can become kind of desensitized then to that. You're talking about craving more extreme, more bloodshed, more body count, you know, more darkness. Do you feel like that is very real? Because we've talked about this before when it comes to violent video games, for example, and, you know, children basically not batting an eyelid to a bit of casual murder when it comes through the screen. So is desensitizing real then when it comes to exposure of these kind of movies?
Yes, it's actually exactly how you would imagine somebody who's taking any kind of substance. So you start off with a little bit and it gives you that that rush, that dopamine rush. And then you need a little bit more to feel the same rush. And then you need more to feel the same rush. So the desensitization is technically of the experience of the dopaminergic reaction. So when we say we're being desensitized, it's literally that we're looking to feel that exact same rush we experienced the first time that we had that fearful experience in a positive way. And usually that requires us doing more and more difficult and risky things.
Ooh.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is all about, well, getting you in the mood for Halloween. One spooky child just for Dr. Thryer. You can see her freaking out on Microsoft Teams. Sorry, Dr. T. So for some of us, nothing compares to a good horror movie. We know it's fake, of course, but that's why it can be so liberating. We get to expose ourselves to this dark, scary side of human nature without actually feeling real fear or harm or guilt. But still, why would we enjoy this? What does it say about us if we love or hate horror movies? Let us know some of your favourites, or if you really don't find them that appealing at all, on 4001. Susan's saying, nope, not a horror film fan, although I do like the funny ones like The Monsters and The Addams Family. My kids love it. Love being scared, although we try and keep it more like Hotel Transylvania than The Exorcist, like you, Dr. Thryer. So we were talking earlier about what kind of different personality types are drawn to it, but what about gender differences? Do men and women view horror films and respond to them differently?
Actually, it's interesting that action horror films are preferred more by men, whereas paranormal horror films are preferred more by women. And studies usually show that in adult, you know, sensation seekers, men are drawn more towards like action and adventure and horror, while women are more toward they lean more towards like new experiences in horror and in movies in general, rather than just horror. Okay. But when you look at the actual horror movies themselves, men tend to look for the violent, frightening kind of visual material way more than women do. And women kind of enjoy these kinds of movies only in the company of a man, more so than not only, but God, more so this, than not in the company of a man.
This kills me. The feminist in me is like, no, I do not need the arm of a man to protect me from a slasher film. But it is a classic kind of first date trope, isn't it? I'll go and see a horror film and you snuggle up and be comforted. So, does watching a scary film with someone affect our feelings towards them, our relationship with them even if it is on a first date?
Interestingly, for women, yes, for men, no. So a woman's appeal had little effect on men when it came to their responses for viewing horror movies, whereas women actually preferred and found a male far more appealing and attractive when they do watch a horror movie with them.
Presumably if they are there to protect you rather than crying and wetting themselves in the cinema. Possibly.
Yes.
Dr. Thry, what are you going to be watching this Halloween weekend? Anything, an old classic or anything new?
I love The Addams Family, so yeah. I might just watch that.
Good. Well, enjoy. It is brilliant. I think that, for me, is my kind of horror film. It's funny. I love like the homes and the costumes, like your Beetlejuice. That's my era. Get any kind of human centipede slasher thing far, far away from me. Dr. Thryer, happy Halloween. Wishing you a wonderful weekend ahead.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Getting you in the mood for Halloween this afternoon, and William Mullally, film expert extraordinaire, on hand to offer up his all-time classics and maybe some new films to throw into the mix this Halloween weekend. William Mullally, what, to your mind, is the scariest film that's ever been made in the history of movie making?
That's the thing, because so much of this is subjective and so much of this is when you see it.
Context, how you see it. Yes.
Context matters. It really does.
Context matters, because I was literally forced by Annabelle Cahoon, I will name and shame her, at a sleepover to watch Silence of the Lambs when I was probably 11. And, I mean, admittedly, I haven't watched it as an adult. And it is a scary film, I'm sure. but I was too young to watch it. I was watching it against my will, and it wasn't age appropriate. So context is everything. Also, it depends on the kind of horror you find scary as well. If it's gore that, you know, really bothers you, if it is the suggestion of danger and threat rather than the, you know, how realistic it is. What scares you?
I think my most vivid memory of being scared by a movie was Scream 2. I was like 10 years old, and I remember sleeping on my friend's floor, convinced I was going to be murdered in any second. I don't know what it was. I was up the entire night just convinced. But it's not even that good of a movie. But I don't know. At the time, that was just the scariest thing I'd ever seen. The Woman in Black as a little kid, too. The ITV version, which still, I think, has some good chills in it. Better than the Daniel Radcliffe. Mm-hmm. Sorry to Harry Potter over there. But I love that one. I'm chasing that feeling now. Like, it's so hard for me to be scared by a movie. So when I find a movie that genuinely unnerves me, yeah, there are different types of, you know, being scared. Those are the movies that I'm always searching for.
Well, what I find interesting is once I got past the Silence of the Lambs trauma, I got really into watching horror films as a teenager. As an adult, not so interested. I can think of just more enjoyable ways to spend my evening. Honestly, I watched Squid Game and was like watching it from between my fingers. Like, I'm just a real wimp now, to be honest. Whereas it sounds like you've perhaps got more hardcore and, you know, your kind of sensitivity has decreased.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Like, you meet, there's different pockets of horror fans, you know? There's the fans that only want the messed up movies, you know? Like, they're looking, they'll just throw names at you, like, oh, have you seen a Serbian film? Have you seen this? It's the human whatever. It's all just, like, there to just gross you out or to put you off or to just, it's like an endurance test. That's not filmmaking. Like, that's really just, like, a viral video that people sent in the 2000s. It's nothing really interesting.
Yeah, for, like,
2 hours.
Whereas
there's other fans. Yeah, there's other horror fans who sometimes they want to be scared, sometimes they want to laugh at, you know, sometimes they want to cheer on Freddy Krueger or Jason, rewatching Friday the 13th. Because if I watch Friday the 13th, like part 4, I'm watching it as a comedy. I'm not watching it as anything else. But I do think that there are some really, really great films that are underrated that I think, even if you don't have the right sensibility for, you know, chasing the grossest or whatever horror movie, then you'll still find something to enjoy.
Okay, right. Let's get a good little list together, though. So putting Scream 2 aside, what are some of your recommendations for this weekend? If we're going to go not so new, so not in the cinema, something you could stream at home.
One film that has become, I think, one of my top 10 films of all time is a film by Kiyoshi Kurosawa from 1997 called Cure, the Japanese film. And it's one of those films where I was watching and I'm like, why is this even kind of a horror movie? There's nothing scary in here. And by the end, I'm just unnerved. Like, I feel different. I'm sitting on the couch. I'm not really talkative anymore. Something about this film just shakes me to my core. And I'm not even sure what it is, but it's made me rewatch it a number of times. And it's, I think, better every time I watch it. It's just an absolute masterpiece. And it's underrated, so I don't think people know about it.
Okay, so this is Cure, as you say, late 90s. What's the premise?
It's about a man who people keep interacting with. He's a man who doesn't remember who he is, why he's there, anything about him. And after they have a conversation with him, they do something terrible.
Oh,
and there's a detective trying to track him down and figure out what's going on and what might be making these terrible actions occur. So I think it's very serious, it's intriguing, beautifully shot, beautifully acted. It's a bit of a slow burn, but in the best possible way.
Now, one film that you've mentioned on the show before is Hereditary, and I wondered if you could tell us why you think that's so scary and who you think might enjoy it.
See, that's the thing. So Hereditary, there's, I think, two categories of horror movies that I have in my head, which are, do I watch this with a horror movie person or a not horror movie person? So Cure is a film I could watch, I think, with anyone. Hereditary, I'm not going to subject that.
I've never seen it because I have Googled it in the past. And there are children involved, and there is nothing scarier to me than scary children. No, thank you. And I love Toni Collette. I love Gabriel Byrne. But anything to do with kids and no, thank you. So, well, you tell me. I'm telling you now. I'm not going to watch it. But what? Who would you think would?
Okay, so I think Hereditary is basically about a family with a daughter who seems to have some sort of, you know, issue with her, and she can't really look after herself. And basically, something happens to the daughter, and it just completely pulls the family apart, which was already fractured. And really, it's about watching them descend separately. And as things do get, you know, a bit supernatural, you know, terrible things happen. But honestly, the most shocking moment of the film is really the most human moment. It's the moment that when something happens to this daughter, and really that it's that one scene alone that means I would never ask you to watch this movie. You know, as horrifying as it gets towards the end when things are getting truly supernatural and over the top, it's that one scene that I don't think I'll ever get out of my head.
Well, it's thank you much, as a friend for not subjecting me to it.
We've had some
messages talking about their favourite films out there. So let us know yours on 4001 if you do like scary movies. No Name on this one saying Midsommar made me feel unlike anything I've ever experienced before. I'm not sure if I actually enjoyed it, but it was really unsettling and visually beautiful. Florence Pugh is such a talent, really commanding on screen. She really is. Neil saying Hereditary is so creepy and I'm hard to unsettle film-wise. And Shane saying, watched Insidious 3 years ago and it hasn't left my brain. Would Insidious make your list?
I still haven't seen it. Oh, I don't know why.
It's your weekend, sorted.
Every other movie that he's seen, exactly. I keep putting it off. The problem is everyone else has seen it. So every time I'm with someone, like, we watch this, they're like, oh, I've seen it.
We're talking then about our kind of formative years when it came to watching scary films. And a message from Beth saying, please help, entry-level horror recommendation for Halloween sleepover, please. 13-year-olds. My boy's watched a lot, but I don't want to emotionally damage his friends. 13 is a pretty pivotal age when it comes to that. Like, I love being frightened. For me, it was that Silence of the Lambs. It was the It. That was my kind of era. Are there any long-standing classics or anything newer you think would be suitable so this parent isn't getting angry phone calls the next day or indeed month?
It is. There are so many tremendous films, I think, from the past to now that are great at just giving a little bit of suspense, especially for someone who doesn't think they're up for horror movies. Some of them are, you know, incredibly famous. The Sixth Sense is still tremendous.
That's a great shout, actually. Sixth Sense is, we think about that kind of, it's not an obvious horror. It's not the bloodbath. It's not, you know, the Blair Witch lurking running. It's suggestive and then the twist. And do you know what? I doubt 13-year-olds in 2021 have actually heard the twist. I think it's probably been off their radar for about 20 years. What else do you think? Gremlins too babyish. Ghostbusters, a classic. But if we want to maybe be a bit scarier, what do you think?
So I think The Others is a tremendous pick when you're younger. Nicole Kidman. Another one with a twist you might not necessarily have heard, which I think holds up great. Coraline.
Oh, it's beautiful.
The Neil Gaiman book. Tremendous. And beyond that, I think you can even try things like The Conjuring, but that might end up making you regret it as a parent after showing it to kids because that is genuinely scary. Something weird that might come. And honestly, I love rewatching old episodes of Are You Afraid of the Dark on YouTube. Some of them are so good.
Is there anything new out this year or even this weekend that you think is worth our hard-earned dirhams at the cinema?
In terms of horror movies?
Yeah, something that's Halloween appropriate.
I think Malignant is great because it's just over the top, insane, off the wall. The new Candyman, I enjoyed a lot, although I think some of the messaging of it is confusing. In cinemas right now, we're at a bit of a dearth for horror. Mm. We do have a new Chucky series that's just launching online, so you can stream that if you want something brand new to dive back into that classic franchise. And I would just see The French Dispatch, even if it isn't a horror movie. But they just kind of snuck it into theaters.
It's always a good time for Wes.
Exactly.
Halloween Kills is out. Worth a watch. Have you seen it yet?
No, I would skip it. I think the last one was a whole lot of fun. It kind of elevated it. This one is kind of just back to just being a basic slasher film, but not really adding anything to the franchise. If that's your bag, sure, go check it out. But it just doesn't really... If the last one really reinvigorated you, this one's not going to do that, sadly.
We will leave it there, William Mullally. Thank you so much. What are you going to be watching this weekend?
Oh, I'm going to be watching the new Ghostbusters tonight, a month ahead of time.
You are such a show-off. What do we need to know? Come on, I want to feel jealous just for a second.
The NDA is to tell you anything that anyone needs to know. I probably shouldn't have even told you that.
No, you're such a tease.
I think that we're bringing in the Stranger Things kids. It's the son of the... Ivan Reitman and Jason doing it. I think for people who are a fan of the originals that didn't really like the remake, that didn't harken back to the original franchise, this is really trying to recapture the heart.
We've got Sigourney Weaver, we've got the original cast, plus, as you say, some of the next generation, and Olivia Wilde, which is always a good thing in my book. Thank you so much, Mullally. Really appreciate it.
Happy Halloween.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune in to Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.